Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery. And that is why the Machinery Digest exists. A no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello and welcome to Idle Chatter. I am Ray Bohax, as the intro music says, and I'm coming to you from Cat Swamp Road in Hackettstown, New Jersey. So hopefully the sound of my voice has things going well for you today, and I'm sure that you're deep into harvest and a lot of guys are done with harvest. And as I said last week, we have listeners around the world, which I'm very, very grateful for, and some of those people are down in Australia, New Zealand, in that part of the world, they're just putting crops in the ground. So I know that they've had a terrible, terrible drought down there. So hopefully, God willing, that they have enough moisture to get the seeds up and to get germination and emergence in whatever they're planting. So it's a rough deal. It seems to be have too much or too little. We've had so far on our farm as of about 5 minutes ago, but it is a sunny day today. It's not raining. We've had 67.5 inches of rain on our farm since January 1st. So it's been the kind of weather. A normal amount of rainfall for Warren County, New Jersey, where we are, is about 48, 49 inches. So if we get another inch and a half, 2 inches, we'll be 20 inches above normal for the year. So, hey, we'll see what happens. But next year, we'll probably be hoping for that rain. And it's crazy things, but I guess that's farming. You know, people say that the weather has changed, and I don't know whether it did or it didn't, but I know you look back in history, and they could say it's been the driest in 100 years, or the wettest in 100 years, or the windiest in 100 years, or the hottest in 100 years, or the coldest in 100 years. So to me, that simply means that 100 years ago, we had the same thing, but it may not have happened in our lifetime. So that is basically it. And I hope that you enjoyed last week's show, which is on diesel engines, a lack of power. And what we're going to do today is we're going to be discussing its counterpart, gasoline engines that have a lack of power. And this is probably a little bit more of an intense discussion than it was last week, because there's so many different gasoline engines out there. And what I don't mean by different brands, that's obviously the case, but you know, there's different types of engines. There's small engines on a lawnmower or on a seed tender. There's a little bit larger engines, maybe on a zero-turn mower or on a small pump or welding unit. And then there's large gasoline engines. And there's gasoline engines in cars and trucks. There's gasoline engines in some older farm equipment. And it basically just takes the whole gamut of different ages, different type of fuel systems, whether it's carbureted, whether it's fuel injected, whether it's direct fuel injected. So it's a pretty broad-based topic. So what I'm going to try to do is break it down into commonalities with the engines, because otherwise we'll be all over the map and it'll be confusing. So the thing is that there are common denominators, just like with crops, right? You need a certain amount of moisture and a certain amount of nutrients to get the crops up and growing. Excuse me, I got a frog in my throat. The crop's up and growing, but with a gasoline engine, you'll have a common denominator for a lack of power, and then there'll be application-specific examples in different pieces of machinery or different designs. So that is what we will do today, and as always, if you have any questions, concerns, input, output, whatever, just send me an email at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com, because you may have a question about something, or it has nothing to do with the topics on the show, or you may have a suggestion for a show. or you may want to argue with me about something, or in this particular instance, you may have a show like the gasoline, and you may say you have a gasoline application that I didn't cover. So I'll be more, I would welcome the opportunity to talk to you and to communicate with you. And as I always say, we could communicate through email, or we could communicate through the telephone. And what I've actually done in some instances, I've had some people contact me from different parts of the world. And specifically, there was a gentleman in South Africa who contacted me with a problem with an older Fargo truck. A Fargo truck, for those up to, for my listeners up in Canada, know that that's a Dodge. And back in the 60s and 70s, they used to brand a lot of Dodge trucks up in Canada as Fargos. I don't know whether they ever truly had Dodge, which is now Ram, right? But they did have Fargo trucks, and this was an old, I think it was a 67 or 68 Fargo on a plantation. What he grew there, I never did know, but plantation in South Africa. And so the reason why I'm telling you this is what I basically did was that I would do an audio file, and I would send him an audio file, and I could email that to him, and it would be a lot better than typing a thesis. So keep in mind that regardless of where you are in the world, I would welcome the opportunity to help you. And we could either go through email, or we could go through an audio file or a phone call or whatever is going to work for you. Get ready. So that is it. And we will get going on the show today. We will have a special delivery question, which is, I think it's a quite interesting question because it's from a gentleman that does farm part-time, and he also works in town. But the problem that he's asking me about is with he's part of the rescue squad. I believe he was from Mississippi. I don't have the letter in front of me, but I believe he's from Mississippi. And he is a problem with one of the rescue squad vehicles. So, you know, that really did my heart good because, as I always say, the engine does not know what it's in. The engine doesn't know whether it's in a piece of farm equipment, a piece of construction equipment, a car, truck, what have you. And that be it, whether it's gasoline, diesel, whatever, it makes no difference, or the hydraulic system or the alternator. You have an alternator, it doesn't know what it's in. So the thing is that the idea that he's taking and listening to the show and then using that information from the show to actually help his fire company and his rescue squad does my heart good, because that's really what this is all about. It's about education, and it's about you being able to take what is being discussed here and modify it to suit your particular situation. You know, as an aside to that, for many years, and I still do it, a column in Hemmings Muscle Machines magazine, it's called Ask Ray. And I get, I've done it for 17, 18 years now. So quite a long time, 12 issues a year. So I get a lot of letters. And you know, when you have an older car, because it's a muscle car enthusiast magazine, so it's predominantly cars in the 60s and 70s. And during what they called the muscle car era, I'm sure a lot of you know what I'm talking about, just like the tractors had a muscle tractor era. I think the tractor collectors called the 60s into the late 70s the muscle tractor era. High horsepower tractors. But anyway, you know, I'd write somebody would, let's say, arguably write me a letter that they have a 69 Rambler Scrambler with a 390, and it's hard starting or it's bulky when it's cold. I'm just making this up as I go along from my memory. And, you know, I would tell them about the, you know, they have to look at the choke, blah, 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 all the other stuff. And that sounds like a choke problem. It sounds like it's the choke isn't closing, or it doesn't have enough spring pressure on it, and it's blowing off too soon, what have you. And I would give them some direction the best I can through a magazine column to check certain things. And then the next month, I would get three or four different letters. Well, I have a Buick, and I have a Pontiac, and I have a Ford, and it has the same problem. Well, you know, I'm not being disrespectful, but a choke is a choke. Well, maybe on a Buick, the adjustment screw is a different place than it is on a Rambler. Or maybe you have to, with a spring tension, the screws are different, but it's still basically the same thing. It's like a spark plug, or it's like a set of points, or an oil filter, is that it doesn't know what it's on. And I'm telling you this because I don't want you to fall into that same trap with the Idle Chatter podcast and my Farm Machinery Digest website. 99% of what I talk about and what is on the website applies to almost anything. So we're starting to get a lot of car people that are listening to the show and going to the website, because as I said, if I have an article on alternators or how to check a charging circuit, it doesn't make any difference what it's on. So I want to just tell that to you. And I just want to, I want to alter your thought process to take what you learn here and apply it to other things on the farm and in your personal life. So, hey, you have a boat, right? And you want to go fishing and the boat engine doesn't start, or the boat engine is bulky when it's cold and it's a carbureted boat engine. Well, you got to look at the choke circuit. It's just like you would look at that muscle car, or you look at the lawnmower, look at anything. So it's something where you really need to apply this and take it across the whole board to get the most value from it. And you know, it's just like growing a crop. You may have a crop, let's say soybeans, that has a little bit different needs than a corn crop or a sugar beet crop or a wheat crop, but the dynamics of growing a crop are still the same. And the reason why I'm telling you this is because I am starting to see a trend now that the show is a little bit more than a year old. And it's great that it has such acceptance, that I say that humbly, but I'm starting to see where it's segmenting, where people think that if I talk about an alternator on a combine, that doesn't apply to their pickup truck, or doesn't apply to their generator set or their irrigation pump. And it does apply to that. And if it doesn't apply to something, then I'll say that it's application specific. But I don't want this, my audience and the agricultural community around the world, to fall into that same trap. So without belaboring that, please think out of the box. And if you look at anybody that's truly successful in life, and I don't care what walk of life it is, it's the people who think out of the box and they apply things that they learn from different areas and take it and bring it home to home, meaning to whatever their particular need is. So that is what we're up today. So, all right, let's talk about gasoline engines. And, you know, a la, like I said last week with the diesel engine, you know, a lack of power complaint is often very hard to diagnose if you don't have the proper thought process. A no start complaint is easier, or no start issue or problem is often easier to diagnose. So something that's a hard failure, if something doesn't work at all, then the thing is that's easier to find, because once you find it, it works. So it's like a person, God forbid, if they had a heart attack, which I don't wish upon anyone, but if they have a true medical issue, let's not say a heart attack, because that's probably not a good, it is a good example, but it's a little bit too sad or morbid for me to discuss, to use that. So let's say you break your leg, right? So you say you fell and you broke your leg and you say, I can't walk because my leg is broken. All right, that's, you know, hey, you go to the orthopedist, he sets a cast on it, does whatever, and it's very obvious why you're having problems walking, because you have a broken leg. But now let's just say that you have a problem, your leg hurts you. And you say, boy, my leg, which I'm going through right now, I think I'm self-diagnosing, I think I have plantar fasciitis in my left foot, which I've had now for about 3 or 4 months, and my heel just kills me when I walk at times. So, but when you have something like that and you say, my leg hurts me, or my shoulder hurts me, or I have a headache, there's nothing that you could really attach to see what's going on. It's not like a broken leg where you say, well, the bone is broken and we need to heal the bone and you'll be fine. So diagnosing an engine that has a lack of power can often be a frustrating exercise. And the traps that people could fall into is to invent their own science. And within the engineering community, we use the term inventing your own science. And that's probably more prevalent today than just in engineering. And what it boils down to is that you really don't know what's going on. You don't know why it's doing what it is. And we're going to invent the science to say we're going to invent something and just give it a name. And not to ruffle a lot of feathers, to a great extent, this whole global warming thing is probably an invented science from my perspective. Like I said, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but from my perspective, so we see different weather patterns than we had 20 years ago. we've had those same weather patterns 100 years ago, so now we want to put a name on it. And lots of times when you're diagnosing something, and specifically a lack of power complaint on an engine, and in this week show a gasoline engine, but this also falls into line for a diesel engine, is that you invent the science. Or maybe it's this, maybe it's that. You know, maybe it's the EGR valve, maybe it's this, maybe it's a distributor, maybe it's a fuel filter, maybe, and what you do is, and those are all possibilities, but you have to realize that everything in life is a possibility. I don't like to deal in possibilities, I like to deal in probabilities. I mean, if I buy a lottery ticket, which I don't do, I'm not a gambler, I'm a Christian man, and I gamble enough with farming, but the if I buy a lottery ticket, there is a possibility I could win whatever, $1 million, $100 million, Mega Millions, whatever the heck that is they have today, all these different lotteries. But I shouldn't quit my day job right before that ticket comes due, because the probability of me winning that $1 million or $10 million, whatever it may be, is not that great, is minuscule, but there always is a possibility. So when you're looking to diagnose an engine for a lack of power complaint and or a no start, but today's show is about lack of power, is that you have to deal in the probability, not the possibility. And if you deal in the probability instead of the possibility, you will spend a lot less money, because most time what people do is they throw parts at it. And they have a no start, they throw parts at it. They have some sort of issue, they throw parts at it. And they keep throwing parts at it, and now they have a whole, what we would call an auto parts store. It may not be an auto parts store, it may be a tractor dealer, it may be a small engine, it may be a Kohler engine. You throw half the Kohler parts department at this engine on this C-tender or what have you. So the thing is that you usually spend a lot of money and a lot of time with this, and it ends up in frustration because you're not diagnosing the problem and you don't have a full understanding of what's going on, or you're not taking any measures to test things, and you're just going about and replacing stuff. Yeah, it makes you feel good at the time, right? Because you say, oh, I put a new carburetor, I put a new distributor, I put new this, I put new that, everything, and I spent all this money, and it still doesn't run right, or it's still a dog or a pig, as we would say in the car hobby. We'd say that, you know, the thing is a real pig. So it means can't get out of its own way. But the fact is that if you don't look at it realistically, you will do that. And getting back to my mantra for this whole journey, I will call the Farm Machinery Digest and Idle Chatter podcast, my whole mantra. And I repeat this to you many times and know that I'm cognizant of it. But through repetition, I want to try to modify your thought process for you to understand and think this way. Is that I always say it, you know, success on the farm, and it could be a farm, it could be a ranch, it could be a vineyard, it could be an orchard, what have you. I'm using the word farm generically. Success on a farm is a three-legged stool. It's yield, it's marketing, and it's using your machinery efficiently and having a minimal amount of investment in your machinery and downtime. And if it, you know, it's a three, I believe that success is a three-cylinder engine. And when you have a three-cylinder engine and you lose one cylinder, the thing hardly runs. It's just a disaster, all right? And the thing, if you have a 12-cylinder engine, you lose one cylinder, you may not even know it. But the more cylinders you have, and if you lose one, there's less of a parasitic drain or impact on them, and financially on your farm or ranch, because this is really what it's all about. I mean, the majority, probably 95% of the listeners to the show are in production agriculture. And the thing is that, you know, it's great to know all this. It's great. You may love engines. You may love vehicles. You may love machinery. But the fact of the matter is that you have to have your machinery to be efficient and reliable and not be a negative cash flow that's going to suck all of the profits from your excellent agronomy or animal husbandry and your excellent marketing. So it's important, and I repeat this many times, as I said, and I'm not going to apologize for it, because I want you to think this way. You know, so many farmers are focused on yield, they're focused on this, and you have to be focused on that. But it's a three-cylinder motor engine, baby, and if you drop out one of those holes in those three cylinders, then this thing is a dog, it's a pig, it's not getting out of its own way. And so many people, you know, financially are doing that to their farm. So I don't want you to spend unnecessary money on repairs, and I don't want you to spend unnecessary time trying to diagnose something. It doesn't mean that you're never going to go off on a tangent, that you're never going to make a mistake, that you're never going to do any of that. No, I'm not talking about that. But you're a human being. We're going to make mistakes. We're going to go to the fork in the road diagnostically, and we may go left when we need to go right. But the fact of the matter is that we have to try to attempt to have the most, in engineering they call it the critical path. That's the quickest path from A to B. And what we need to do is find that critical path, because instead of you jerking around in the farm shop trying to get the seed tender motor running so you can plant your soybeans, I'd rather have you be efficient to get that. First of all, I'd rather have you take care of it properly so it doesn't break down. And I'd rather have you out in the field planting instead of jerking around and spending money with a tender engine or anything. So that's why I think that this all comes together. It's not the idea of a lack of power. It's not the idea of that it's a race. But in lots of times, it is a race for you to get a crop in. And any time that's wasted and resources that are wasted are taking away from your core business. And your core business is growing something so you have something marketable to sell. And everything else is a tool. This engine is a tool for you to be able to bring your product to market. So at one particular stage in its production cycle. So anyway, so we've quantified, I should say, we probably didn't put a number to it. So we qualified that this particular gasoline engine is not what it used to be anymore. And as I said last week, I'm going to talk with the diesels. I'm going to talk about different aspects. Obviously, if it has no compression in it or it has poor ring seal, the way you would determine the compression very easily, as 99% of everyone listening, would be through a compression test. But then you also would do a leak down test. And a leak down test is a very accurate test for cylinder sealing. A compression test is the engine's ability to pump air. A leak down test is how much of that cylinder pressure will that has been pumped will stay in the bore and not leak past the ring. So the way I talk about it is that a compression test is putting air in the tire, and if you could put and the leak down test is how fast the air is leaking out of that tire that has a nail in it. So if you could put the air in quicker than it's leaking out, that tire is going to build pressure. And if you could move more air through the engine and it leaks out slower than you're putting in, then that engine will have compression. It'll have, if you put a compression gauge on, it'll have cylinder pressure during cranking. But a leak down test has the piston static, and you have a special tool called a leak down test. They're not expensive. They're probably a decent one's on $100 or $150. And you use shop air, and you put 100 pounds of air into a cylinder, and it goes and it basically measures how much of that air is leaking out. So if you have 10%, that means 90% of the air, the pressure is staying in the cylinder, 10% is leaking out. If you have 90% leak down, then only 10% of the cylinder is staying charged with air. So we're not going to talk much about that today because we have too much ground to cover. But we're going to talk about other things that will, because a leak down test or a compression test historically will show you an engine that is not sound mechanically. They could have worn rings. It could have glazed cylinder walls. It could have an out of shape cylinder wall, a lot of egg-shaped cylinder where the rings are on sealing. It could have a poor sealing valves. It could have a burnt valve. So those are basic mechanical issues. And what I want to talk about is ancillary. Yes, they're mechanical in a sense, but they're ancillary to the internal health of the engine. And that's usually where you will find most of your lack of power complaints. Now, keep in mind, though, that on a turbocharged engine, both gasoline and diesel, and most people don't do a leak down test on a diesel because it's a lot harder and the bore is a lot larger. And we could discuss that in some future show. But anyway, when you do a leak down test, you know, keep in mind that if it is a turbocharged engine, then what will happen is that as the cylinders leak a lot of air, that you will have less volumetric efficiency, which in turn will give the engine less potential power. Now, keep in mind that when you read boost pressure on any type of turbocharged engine, be it gasoline or diesel, you're reading the pressure in the intake manifold. So the pressure in the intake manifold would stay could very arguably stay exactly where it's supposed to be. Let's say this engine runs 20 pounds of boost under load. And the fact is that if it's staying at 20 pounds of boost, because you're reading in the intake manifold, the problem is if you have poor ring seal or poor valve seal, that it's not staying in the bore. And that's where your lack of power complaint comes from. So keep in mind that that's why a leak down test is a valid tool, because you could have boost pressure, and turbocharged engines are very, very prone to this. They'll have good boost, but there'll be a lack of power, and that is because the rings aren't sealing. And there's a lot of turbocharged gasoline engines in use today. All right, so what I'm going to go through these things in no particular order, and just to bring them to light to you, for you to think about that with a gasoline engine. As I said in the beginning of the show, that this is basically going to be gasoline engines, and from a one-cylinder Briggs & Stratton on a lawnmower to a old 600 cubic inch a GMC V8 and an irrigation pump. All right, so we're going to go through them in no particular order. But number one is ignition advance. If you have an engine that does not have ignition enough or sufficient ignition advance, or the wrong amount of ignition advance, then it is going to either be down on power or it's going to detonate and ping. And those two are kind of linked together. Now, what is the purpose of ignition advance? The purpose of ignition advance on a gasoline engine is to give the flame a head start so it could catch up with the piston. Now, contrary to what many people would believe, the flame, once it's ignited by the spark plug, does not travel across the bore as quickly as the piston moves. And on a gasoline engine, a rule of thumb for most engines is that you want peak cylinder pressure from combustion, from the burning of the fuel, the expansion of the fuel, to occur with the piston about 6 degrees after top dead center. So now the thing is that if the flame moves slower than the piston is moving, we have to give the flame a head start. So that is what ignition advance is. It's the head start. It's the amount of degrees before top dead center, the piston, before the piston reaches top dead center, that the initiation, the arcing of the spark plug, which is actually called the ionization. So in case you ever go on Jeopardy, right, they say, what's the ionization of a spark plug? That's actually when the arc is formed across the spark plug, ignites the combined fuel and air mixture, and this flame starts to expand across the bore and drive the piston down. So ignition advance is basically giving the flame a head start to catch up with the piston. Now, if you do not have enough of advance, what's going to happen is the piston is already going to be at bottom dead center, and the exhaust valve is going to be open, and that flame is going to burn out, meaning it's going to travel, and that heat energy is going to travel out the exhaust valve. If you have too much advance, you're starting the flame too early, what's basically will happen is the converse of that. It's not going to burn out the intake valve, but as the piston is starting to come up to top dead center, the flame is already initiated, and now the inertia of the crankshaft is trying to drive this piston up against the expanding flame. So the expanding flame causes a lot of resistance, which is now becomes a parasitic loss inside that engine, and now it is used to it is consuming the power from the other cylinder vents, because it is the piston has to try to push against an expanding flame. So now the thing you may say to yourself, well, the thing is that's, you know, hey, Ray, what difference does it make? I look at the specifications. The specifications say 6 degrees before top dead center. That's why I set it at. And I did a show on that a while back about with specifications at a starting point only, is that the key to spark advance, the key to the proper spark advance curve is to begin with the specification and then adjust it either more advanced or less advanced and see how the engine likes it, because there's a number of things that are happening. Number one, as the engine gets older and the ring seal may not be bad but starts to go away or builds carbon deposits, the flame speed is going to vary. there's no way that it's going to be impacted, not varied. There's no way that you're going to be able to anticipate which way the flame speed goes. If the ring seal goes away, then historically what's going to happen is the flame speed is going to slow down, and you're going to need more of a head start to get that piston, that cylinder pressure, where it's going to be. The other thing is that the burn rate of gasoline today is different than it was. So if you have an older engine, something from the 50s, the 60s, 70s, the 80s, and you're using modern RFG gasoline in it, is that the burn rate of today's gasoline is different than it was years ago. I'm not going to tell you whether it's faster or slower, but the burn rate is different. So what's going to happen is that specification for that 1975 Chevy truck C60 that you're using to haul grain, that specification in the book, in the owner's manual, in the shop manual, is going to be for gasoline that was made in 1975. So you have to be a tuner. You have to be a tweaker. You have to be able to say, okay, fine, this is a starting point. And then also what you will find that happens specifically with older engines is that the weights in the distributor freeze. They freeze and they get stuck. They may get stuck. That's the centrifugal weights. And if the unit has a vacuum advance, that's going to move the breaker plate, that those units freeze and get stuck. And they may not get stuck at the at-rest position. So it may be where it's stuck, where it's partially out, and now the engine started to ping, so you retarded the timing, you moved the position of the distributor to compensate for that. And this, you know, this could be on a gasoline tractor also. It doesn't have to be on a truck or be on anything, as I said. So the thing that you need to come into play here to recognize is that on an older engine, that the spark advance curve is going to be the starting point. It may want more advance, it may want less advance, less base timing. And then you need to use a timing light that has, the easiest way is to have a timing light that's called a dial back timing light with advance on it. And you need to be able to identify what the spark advance curve is. You may find that the weight in a distributor, the pin where the weight of the focal point, the fulcrum, not focal, fulcrum point of the weight, and where the spring may be weak. So it may be fine at 2,000 RPM, at 3,000 RPM, the weights fly all the way out. And also a lot of distributors on older engines have a bushing there, and that bushing limits the amount of total advance. If that bushing is usually it's a nylon type of plastic. Over time, that bushing could deteriorate and fall off. And then what will happen is that the advance curve will keep advancing through centrifugal force as the RPM goes up. And then now you have an engine that pings at higher load, at higher engine speed, and you're retarding the timing downstairs to stop the ping, which now takes all your power away. So now keep in mind, so you need to understand that the engine needs to have spark advance, and it needs to have the proper amount of timing. And to reiterate is that this is going to be a try it and see what happens. You may have two engines that are exactly the same. This one has more carbon deposits in it. This one, whatever, better ring seal, less ring seal. And you need to, this one may want 12 degrees at idle, and the other one may want 8 degrees at idle. This one may want 30 degrees total advance. The other one may want 35. So keep that in mind, that it's only a starting point, but spark advance too much or too little will give you a lack of power complaint. Now, if you're dealing with a small engine, let's say like I call it a lawnmower type of engine, a seed tender, usually those engines are designed to run at 3,600 RPM, and they don't have an adjustable distributor, but they're designed for the weights to come out in that magneto to bring it up for the proper timing at 3,600 RPM, and you can identify a timing mark on those in most applications, but in some instances you cannot, because if it's hooked up to something, you may have to pull it apart. It's not convenient. But keep in mind that that is a problem with those engines also, that if the weights stick on them, then you're going to have a problem. If it sticks out, then you're going to have advance when you don't want it, and if they stick in at the at rest position, it's going to have zero advance. All right, next thing is a lean mixture. And if you don't have enough fuel to get into the combustion chamber, be it gasoline or fuel injections, that the engine is not going to produce power. So we need to confirm the air-fuel ratio. And the old way of looking at a spark plug is really not accurate. And I mean, yes, if it's way, way off, it's like looking at crops without a soil test. If you say, well, you know, the crop is all shriveled up and dying or whatever, I guess it's lacking something. But, you know, spark plug, if you pull a spark plug color, pull a plug out, and the color is very, very white or very, very black, that you're at extremes ends of the spectrum. But usually you will find is that a lack of power complaints, specifically with a carburetor and with fuel injection also, will not have an idle problem. And what it'll usually do is have a problem under load where you're looking for power. So the thing is that on the carburetor, one of the common areas for a lack of power is the float level is wrong. The float level is too low. Why is the float level too low? It could be a number of different things. It could be somebody fooled around with the float at one particular point and bent it. They could be sticking or what have you. All right. So historically, it's a float level that is too low. A float level that is too high will usually not give you a lack of power. It'll give you a rich running condition right off idle. But on fuel injection, there is no float. So the fuel injection keeps the fuel rail primed and full at the operating pressure. So if you have an engine that is lacking power, then it is very possible on a carburetor that the float level is too low, on fuel injection that the volume of fuel or the operating pressure is too low. And the, you know, it's a pressure flow relationship because it's hydraulics. So almost every fuel injection system has a pressure port on it, a Schrader valve, where you could hook up a pressure gauge. And the good way to do this, if it's a vehicle that's, or if it's an engine that's in a vehicle that's going to go down the road, is that you could take this, you could buy a kit in town, it's not expensive, to test fuel pressure, and you could take, and what I like to do is tape the fuel pressure gauge to the windshield. You could use duct tape, because you don't want to bring a pressure gauge into the vehicle with gasoline under 40, 50, 60, 70 pounds of pressure. So you could look at this specification, let's say it's 45 degrees at idle, 45 pounds at idle, with the vacuum hose off the regulator, you put the vacuum hose back on the regulator, and now you drive this vehicle, you load it, or if it's an EFI engine on irrigation pump, right, then what you basically do is you start the pump and you load and you watch that fuel pressure, because it's a pressure flow relationship. As the flow starts to go down, then the pressure is going to go down and that engine is going to run lean. And keep in mind that you could actually run the engine lean enough to burn a piston or burn a valve and hurt it. All right, but in most instances, you probably will not. But under a constant load, like an irrigation pump, all right, you can very easily do that. Or if you have an older, let's say like a hay barn or something, it has a gasoline engine, and you're loading it. Now, the same thing would happen on a carburetor, is that on a carburetor, you're not going to have that high of pressure. Most carburetors run about 7 pounds of pressure. But what you could do is hook up a pressure gauge to that, and tee it in. However you have to do to tee it in is fine. But the problem, usually a low float level you could kind of detect without a pressure gauge. But, you know, as being a proper mechanical procedure, you do. And people, you know, we always check fuel pressure on carburetors and race cars. People on the farm don't check fuel pressure on carburetors. And oftentimes fuel pressure on carburetor will give you, it'll idle fine, it'll cold start fine, it'll hot start fine, and then it gives you that as you go into the throttle or load the motor. It's got that bog, that load to it, just lazy. It almost sounds like that because you hear the air sucking because you're opening the throttle plate more because it's bogging. So keep in mind that fuel pressure will do that. Alrighty? So fuel pressure and volume is key, is paramount, the proper air fuel ratio to have to create the proper power. Because remember, the power comes from the fuel. It's an engine converts chemical energy to mechanical energy. Now, the other thing basically is that if the engine has a worn timing chain or worn timing belt, depending upon the application. As the timing, we'll call it the timing chain, as the timing chain wears, what's going to happen is the phase of the camshaft, which is the relationship of the lobe center line, if you look at the lobe, the center of that lobe to the crankshaft position, this is not the distributor, but the relationship of the lobe of the camshaft to the crankshaft, the piston's position, right, via the crankshaft, will change and retard. And as the timing chain wears, what will happen is that the valve timing will retard. It will become late. And as the valve timing becomes late, the bottom end and the mid-range of the engine will dramatically decrease. There will be a pig downstairs. Then, interestingly enough, at higher RPM, if it has enough fuel and everything, it'll actually feel better at higher RPM, because now the valve events will start to come into place and to be more into proper phase. So in essence, you need to look at that and the timing chain versus, or the timing belt. Now, if the timing chain is very, very worn, let's stick with that, and the engine has a distributor, it's an older engine, be it fuel injected or carbureted with a distributor, usually one of the telltale signs is that the distributor timing is way off. He said, geez, how the hell did this get so off? It's so retarded. And then the pinch bolt is tight and everything. And the fact is that, but usually at that particular point, the chain is very, very worn. So keep in mind that a worn timing chain on a more modern engine, a worn timing belt, will actually change the phase of the camshaft and will give the engine a lack of power, specifically right off idle, to about its midpoint in its RPM range. And then after that, it'll start to come back into phase and start to feel a little bit better. But if you're working an engine under load, it's that low RPM, that low point when you're putting that load on the engine. You're trying to pull a grain cart. You're trying to pull a combine header. You're pulling a load of cattle. You're putting a load on the irrigation pump. You're putting a load on a gasoline-powered welding unit. When that load comes on and they get that sag, then a lack of power that usually doesn't recover, because it can't pull itself up to an RPM range where it could start to work more efficiently. So a worn timing chain will definitely do that. All right, so keep that in mind. Another thing that's very common, especially once a vehicle on an application, is probably a better way for me to say it, with a catalytic converter, and that is a restricted exhaust. If the engine is running too rich, what will happen is the material in the catalyst will actually become superheated, the honeycomb, and it's called a monolith, and it'll melt down and it'll plug. And if the engine has a restricted exhaust, it will not be able to breathe, and it can restrict itself to such a level that the engine one day will not even start. That's not going to happen overnight, right? First of all, it's going to become doggier and doggier, piggier and piggier, and then one day when it gets so bad, the engine will not start, or it will start at a run at maybe 400 RPM, like that, and you won't be able to give it any throttle. And the easiest way for you to tell if it has a plugged catalytic converter, I mean, you could put a vacuum gauge on it, but if you don't have access to a vacuum gauge, how you would tell with a vacuum gauge is that you look at the engine idle at vacuum, and then you would, let's say it's got 15 inches at vacuum, and then you would raise the RPM to about 2,000 RPM and steady and hold it there steady. And the thing is that the vacuum should then increase. So it went to from 15, it should go to 17, 18, 19, 20, right, 21, what have you. If the vacuum stays the same as you raise the RPM and stabilize the throttle, they hold it at 2,000 RPM, and the vacuum goes down from 15 to 10 or 11, then that engine has a restricted exhaust. And on a later engine, you could pull the oxygen sensor out if it's easy to get to, or just drop down the pipe, and then you could see if there's a restriction. Most likely, the restriction would be in the catalytic converter if that engine has one. But that's the most common area of restriction, and is the most detrimental. But you could have a restriction in the exhaust. You could have a piece of equipment, and over the winter time, mice went in there and they filled the whole muffler up with a nest and with corn and what have you, and then you have a restriction in the exhaust. So keep in mind that a restriction in the exhaust is going to give you a lack of power. The engine will idle fine in most instances until it gets too bad. And then from there, but a vacuum gauge test, manifold vacuum, full-time vacuum, look at the vacuum at idle, and then raise the RPM up to about 2,000 RPM, 2,100. It's not rocket science. You want to get the piston velocity up higher, and then it should now increase. If it hardly increases, only increases 1 or 2 inches of mercury, then there's a restricted exhaust, but it's the beginning of a restriction. But most likely what it'll do is it will go, and it'll just go drop off fall off the cliff, go down to 9 inches of mercury. All right, so that's a very common complaint, a very common cause, I should say, for a lack of power. And we discussed this last week with diesel, with like a plugged up diesel particulate filter. And the other thing that I want to discuss before we bring this to a close here is that carbon deposits on the backside of the intake valve limit airflow. And it's very, very, very common on all types of engines, from an engine on a lawnmower, seat tender, to a truck, to a UTV, ATV, to build carbon deposits on the back of the valve. When the carbon deposits form on the back of the valve, the effective port area becomes diminished and you are choking the engine. Just like if you were to choke it with an air filter, but you're choking it in a cylinder head. And the thing is that will build up over time, but you will find that you have enough carbon deposits that you could lose 20 or 30 or 40% of that engine's potential power. And that power will be lost throughout the RPM range. So it may idle fine, all right? It may idle fine, but once you start to add some load on it, so arguably, let's say at 30% throttle angle, this engine should make 50 horsepower. At arbitrary numbers, at 30% throttle angle, it's making 20 horsepower. So carbon deposits are a big problem. They were a problem years ago, always been a problem, but a lot of today's fuel and I don't want to say it's really the fuel. Well, it is the fuel in part, but the way the engines are used, if they're not used on the highway a lot or a lot under load, if it's not a highway engine, if it's a stationary engine, has a lot of cold starts. Your person is not good with changing the oil on it, or they're using the wrong chemical composition oil, or they're using a fuel that has the propensity to build a lot of deposits, and they don't use a chemical cleaner in there to remove those deposits, they will build up like plaque on your teeth. They will build up like corrosion in a pipe, and they will limit the flow. And oftentimes, all you need to do is chemically remove those carbon deposits. You don't need to take the motor apart. But keep in mind that you're not going to get rid of 1,000 hours worth of deposit formation with one bottle of in-tank cleaner, right? So the fact that, you know, it's like soil fertility. You don't want to mine it. You want to keep the soil fertility where the plant needs to be and actually build that fertility. You don't want to build deposits. But carbon deposits have caused a lot of engines to go to the junkyard because the person thought that the engine was tired and there was really nothing wrong with it. Carbon on the backside of the intake valve, and it's called IVD, intake valve deposits. And you could use a chemical cleaner, an in-tank chemical cleaner. I particularly like Chevron Techron Complete Fuel Systems cleaner, but there are other products also. But it has to be something that's going to remove the deposits. And if you're patient and you have a lot of carbon deposits, then you could keep treating your fuel 4, 5, 6 tanks in a row, then you will see that those deposits will start to burn off. But you have to be patient. And if it's a type of engine that you don't have that much ability to run 5 or 6 tanks of fuel through, then the only way to truly get rid of those deposits is to pull the cylinder head off and to actually clean and scrape off those intake valve deposits. And what you have to remember, as I said, and I can't stress this enough, there's many engines, specifically smaller engines, and then into mid-sized engines that are junked because they think that the thing is shot. They didn't do a compression or leak down test. They didn't do anything. Just know that it has no power. They can't do the work that needs to be done in the farm. And they're buying, whether it's a $300 engine or a $3,000 engine, all right, because of carbon deposits on the intake valves. And with the newer gasoline direct injection vehicles, which is very common today in your passenger cars, then also your light-duty gasoline pickup trucks, is that those deposits are very, very prone to form, and they're a little bit more difficult to remove. But I think in a couple of weeks, I'm going to do a show on gasoline direct deposit engines and what needs to be done, because a lot of pickup trucks and a lot of family vehicles are coming with them today. And I think it's imperative that you understand what needs to be done with that, because like I said, I'm getting back to the same thing. If the engine is not running right in your pickup truck and you have to bring it to town and spend $3,000 to fix it, it was something that was avoidable, that $3,000 is coming from the farm income. And that $3,000 is much better spent, in my estimation, with fertility, with anything else than a unnecessary repair. Well, likewise, if your wife's car or your family car, whatever, has an issue, and the lion's source or all of your income is from your agricultural operation, then you're taking those monies from that agricultural operation to fix something that really didn't need to be fixed if you would have had an understanding on it. So I think what I'm going to do is do a show on gasoline direct deposit, gasoline direct injection deposit engines, probably in a few weeks before the holidays, so you could have understanding with that. And with those engines, just to keep in mind, is something, there's a phenomenon called LSPI, which is low speed pre-ignition, which actually is destroying the engines. And if it's out of warranty, the manufacturer doesn't cover it. So, to that same point is that I want you to learn about those engines, what you could do very simply to not experience an LSPI event with either a bent connecting rod or a ring land off a piston and have to put a $6,000-$7,000 engine in your pickup truck when it's out of warranty because you don't understand it. So, now that I'm talking to you with this show, I think that I will do a show on that. I was playing around with that and I didn't know whether I was going to do that or not. So listen, in closing, let's recap real quickly, and then we're going to get to our toolbox test question, and we're going to get to our letter from a reader. I'm so used to being in magazines, reader, from a listener. So basically, to recap quickly, ignition advance, lean mixture, fuel pressure, float level, worn timing chain or timing belt, restricted exhaust, and carbon deposits are your main what I'm calling external things, not that the engine is not sound mechanically, that will create a lack of problem. And oftentimes, if you have an older engine, that you will find that there is a few things going on, right? So any questions, I went through it quickly, and any questions, please feel free to contact me at Hot Rod Farmer at farmmachinerydigest.com. So now what we're going to do is I'm going to introduce my toolbox test, and we're still on test number one. This is question four, but I'm very proud to tell you that the toolbox test each week is being brought to you by Agro Liquid, and that they are a high efficiency liquid fertilizer company. I use that on my farm, and I just want you to know that anybody that comes on this show that I talk about, whether it's Agro Liquid, Firestone, anybody else, that I believe 110% in those products, 130%. And if I didn't believe in them, I would not actually even mention them on the show. So Agro Liquid, check them out. It's perfectly calibrated crop nutrition, superior quality, superior delivery, superior results. And superior results basically mean that you have a superior yield. And that is the one part, right, of success on the farm, is to have a great yield. And Agro Liquid, through their agronomic program, will help you and will teach you. And listen, I ask you to explore it. Do your due diligence. Don't believe me. You check it out. You go to Agro Liquid. You talk to them. You go to their website, you find their rep, and you see how they could apply that technology, that superior fertility technology, to your crops. But before we get into that toolbox test, we have to have Tex Rubinowitz from Ripsaw Records, right? And the Hot Rod Man, give us our intro music. So come on, Tex, we're going to have to hit it. Here he comes.
I'm a hot rod man. Yeah, I'm a hot rod man. Look out, little mama, gonna get you if I can.
All righty. Thank you so much, Tex. I love that song, and hopefully you do too. And it is from Roadhouse 66. And it was in that movie, but I love that Hot Rod Man. Once I listen to that, I get it singing in my head for the rest of the day. Don't you hate when you get a song in your head? Well, I guess Tex doesn't mind if you get his song in his head. And that is Tex Rubinowitz, Hot Rod Man, and I'm the Hot Rod Farmer. I think you guys are Hot Rod Farmers too. All righty, and that's from Ripsaw Records. All right, so now we're going to have our question. You were out yesterday side dressing your corn and it was hot outside, right? And maybe it's not appropriate for this time of year, but all right, but still the value of the question is, the air conditioner in the tractor is not working too well and you noticed that you heard the AC compressor cycling on and off quickly. You stopped in the field and got out and opened the hood. The compressor was kicking the clutch in and out every few seconds. You got the nitrogen and micronutrients down, but it was not a comfortable ride. Which farmer knows why the compressor was cycling so fast? So basically, in essence, you're out there and it's any type of application that the compressor is cycling on and off quickly. The discharge temperature from the duct in the vehicle or the piece of equipment is not cold. It's lukewarm or cool, and it's not doing its job. Farmer A says that the alternator must be weak and not supplying enough juice to the compressor, and that's why it's kicking in and out. Farmer B thinks the condenser is plugged with chaff and debris and the system has no air. Farmer C tells you the temperature control in the cab is bad and putting the heat on at the same time. Farmer D insists that the AC is low on refrigerant. So those are your choices. Don't worry about whether it's farmer A, B, C, or D. Worry about why that air conditioner compressor is cycling on and off. So now what we're going to do is go into our special delivery segment, and that is brought to us by Firestone Ag, a company founded by Harvey Firestone, a fourth generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. Harvey dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and that innovative mindset, that mindset of a farmer, right? He's pushing the envelope, is the core of Firestone Ag today, and lives on with their 23-degree tread bar design, AD2 technology. They got this great new Evo tire. Check that out for older equipment that you don't want to, you want a quality tire, but not the most technologically advanced tire, and now the Firestone of tracks, replacement tracks. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. So now we have our question, and I finally figured out after all this time that I need to save those emails into a Word document, and then I could go on them and make the font bigger so I could read it like I understand how to read them, all right? So it says, hi, my name is George Taylor. We have a small farm in Mississippi, and I work in town at a feed mill. I really enjoy your podcast and website. I have learned a lot from you in a short time. Well, thank you, Mr. Taylor. I am also part of our local rescue squad. One of our trucks is a 1999 Chevy C30 with an automatic transmission. The squad got it new and it has about 135,000 miles. Recently, the transmission started acting up, so we had it rebuilt. About 2,000 miles later, the engine developed low oil pressure and started to knock. It now needs to be rebuilt. I told the fire chief that I would ask you if it had something to do with the transmission. We do not want to blame people, but it is an awful coincidence, and I know that you will tell us the truth. Thanks. Well, thank you very much for listening, sir, and I'm sorry that you had that bad incident. But to tell you the truth, like I said earlier in the show, and just so coincidentally that I got this letter that I chose to read today, is that I deal in probabilities and not possibilities. And the fact of the matter is that if an engine, and this goes for any application, if you take a transmission out, it could be an automatic or a clutch or manual transmission, what have you, and then shortly thereafter that it starts to lose oil pressure and starts to knock, then there's a very good possibility that the thrust bearing on the crankshaft, and the thrust bearing on the crankshaft controls the axial movement, or what's called the end play in the crankshaft, and the thrust bearing on the crankshaft, or the thrust on the crankshaft, the end play, was pushed all the way forward by either the clutch not being installed right, or in this particular application, the automatic transmission. And lots of times with an automatic, it's not even that it's not installed correctly, because it's very hard to install it incorrectly, but you could have a number of things that will cause a thrust load to come onto that flex plate or flywheel and push that crankshaft forward into gets that thrust bearing. And once it wipes out that thrust bearing, you're going to lose oil pressure and the engine is going to start to knock. It could be something as simple as a kinked line going to the cooler. if you have a kinked transmission line going to the cooler, then what will happen is that the pressure in the pump will be escalated, and that'll be a pusher, put a load against that flex plate or that flywheel. And you know, that load could become 2,000 pounds, like a ton on there, right? So you could have something like that. The person could have put the, they could have replaced the torque converter bolts and had too long a bolt, and it could be pushing into that, taking up that thrust, that free play on the crank. So, you know, I don't see it, but what's basically going to happen is what you're going to need to do is that when that engine goes back together and you repair what it is that you're going to have to look at that transmission, whoever's doing that engine, and you're going to have to, obviously, any good engine build will identify before the engine goes in what the free play on the crank is, the axial movement, and you do that with a dial indicator on the back of the crankshaft, and with the, and you pry on the crankshaft and read the value, and there's a specification for it. And then you would need to also do that once that transmission is installed. Because if it's something like a kinked line to the cooler, or it's the wrong converter bolts, or the shop changed the converter, and the converter is an aftermarket converter, it's a little bit longer, or the snout is a little bit longer on it, or what have you, and it's pushing up against that flywheel, that's actually a flex plate and automatic, you're going to take that thrust out. So it's very important for you to be able to measure that thrust when that engine is back together, first on the engine stand and then in the truck with the transmission attached to it. And if the thrust is not there, the free play is not there, then don't even start that engine, because what's going to happen is you're going to end up wiping out those bearings. And sadly, it could very possibly be coincidental, but I doubt very much if you're going to wipe out bearings in 2,000 miles after a transmission job, without having a problem with the thrust and the end play and the crankshaft. And sadly, I think it is part of the transmission. And like I said, it could be a kink line. So please look into that. Let me know. Please feel free to email me if I could be any further help. Alrighty, the answer to our question is going to be Farmer D is correct. When a modern AC system is low on refrigerant, it will cycle the clutch on and off quickly, and the duct discharge temperature will be high. So if you have any AC system on any of your equipment and it starts to cycle the compressor in and out every second, a few seconds, then historically it is because it is low on refrigerant. We used to call it Freon, but Freon is actually a brand name, and today it's not even, it's R134A, but it is low on refrigerant. So that goes back to an old R12 system to the most modern system that you would find out there today. All right, so listen, I want to thank you so much for listening, and I hope that you gained a little bit of knowledge on why a gasoline engine may have a lack of power, and know that the hot rod farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved America. You have a blessed day. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.